supreme function of statesmanship is to provide against preventable evils. In seeking to do so, it encounters obstacles which are deeply rooted in human nature. One is that by the very order of things, such evils are not demonstrable until they have occurred. At each stage in their onset, there is room for doubt and for dispute whether they be real or imaginary. By the same token, they attract little attention in comparison with current troubles, which are both indisputable and pressing. Whence the besetting temptation of all politics to concern itself with the immediate present at the expense of the future. Above all, people are disposed to mistake predicting troubles for causing troubles, and even for desiring troubles, if only, they love to think, if only people wouldn't talk about it, it probably wouldn't happen. Perhaps this habit goes back to the primitive belief that the word and the thing, the name and the object, are identical. At all events, the discussion of future, grave, but with effort now, avoidable evils, is the most unpopular and at the same time the most necessary occupation for the politician. Those who knowingly shirk it deserve and not infrequently receive the curses of those who come after.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Peter Gumley back on the show. He returns to discuss an article that he wrote recently regarding the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. I believe it was September 8th of all days that she went on to her eternal reward. Queen Elizabeth and the Great Silence. And it discusses the legacy of Elizabeth II and how during her reign she sort of passively accepted her country, her realm's decline into sort of neoliberalism, further apostasy that began a long time ago in Great Britain. But sort of this decline that we've all witnessed regarding Great Britain since the Second World War, she presided over, I guess, most of it since 1952. Yeah, 70-year reign. So Peter, let's talk about the article.
Hello, Tim. It's very good to be back on Powers and Principalities. I always value the quality of your programs and the acute analysis that you routinely offer.
Oh, thank you. Hey, sorry. Did I mention you're the host of Vendée Radio?
I don't know if you did, but thanks very much for mentioning it.
Yeah, we had a couple of false starts, so I might have forgot. You're the host of Vendée Radio, which is a regular podcast. You post, I guess, regularly or intermittently? What's your posting rate?
I think intermittently would be a fairer description. Whenever I get the time, really, but I try to prioritize quality over quantity, and regularity sometimes suffers with
quality
that,
but... over quantity. That's not, you know, that's not what we're all about here in the West these days. So what you're saying is you have like an honest job or something.
Yes.
As they say.
I try to, yeah.
Okay, so let's this piece, Queen Elizabeth and the Great Silence, and you start with a quote from, of course, from Thomas More, appropriately, I think.
Yeah, so I would like to give credit to the YouTube channel Apostolic Majesty for identifying this key theme with regard to Queen Elizabeth II's reign, the reign of the late Queen, which is that of silence, because I think many listeners will be familiar with the quote from A Man for All Seasons, where St. Thomas More is defending his position with regard to his public silence regarding Henry VIII's remarriage to Anne Boleyn, and the courtiers and the ministers are required to acclaim that union, and he hasn't done so, and so he's falling under suspicion, but he's making recourse to the Latin legal proverb, qui tacit consentit, which is he who is silent is given to consent, and argues that if there is doubt about his silence, it should be construed as consent or acquiescence to the marriage. But it's actually it's verifiable from his life. We have from the major biography and a recent reprint by Stapleton, T. Stapleton. He says, "My silence is no proof of malice, as his majesty can well know by my many other tokens, nor is it shown to be any disapproval of your law. Indeed, it should be taken rather as a mark of approval than of disapproval, in accordance with the common legal rule, he who is silent seems to consent." And then as an extension, "he who is silent seems to consent, for he ought to have spoken when he was able." Now, apostolic majesty quite rightly, I think, applied that principle to the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, because amidst the analysis, evaluation, coverage that we've experienced all around the world, but particularly in the United Kingdom and the other Commonwealth realms, what's quite striking is how quickly the commentators reach a limit of things to actually say about the Queen herself, despite 70 years of her reign. And that's really because she maintained a studied, pragmatic silence with regard to the vast changes that occurred in the span of those years. So despite all of the emotions that I think have surfaced, the national emotions that have surfaced in this period of national mourning, it's been difficult to ascertain the Queen's involvement and interaction with those events in that time, at least on a superficial sort of mainstream media level of analysis. Now, I maintain that actually there are two parts of the Queen's political action, which we can consider: her legislative action. No legislation becomes law without the royal assent, and then her non-legislative or discretionary political action, which are things like comments and speeches and so on. And I think actually one can construe quite a lot from this apparent silence in her reign. And I'm afraid that what one can construe is in a large degree acquiescence with the power structure, with the revolutionary elite, in their project, which is the panorama in which we live, namely the dissolution of what remains of Christendom and the coagulation of an anti-Christendom of this Judeo-Masonic revolutionary order. And I think the first thing to address, perhaps, is this idea of this label that's applied to the Queen, of her being apolitical. I'd like to refer to the 1991 Catechism. It's not my go-to catechism, but it does have a good statement in this regard. It says, quote, "Every institution is inspired, at least implicitly, by a vision of man and his destiny, from which it derives the point of reference for its judgment, its hierarchy of values, its line of conduct," end quote. So there is no such thing as apoliticism in concrete reality. We can abstract the idea of political neutrality, of apoliticism, but like liberalism and its ostensible neutrality, actually that's just a mirage for its true actions in the world, which betray a necessary political stance one way or the other. And if you'd like me to just begin by looking at those discretionary, non-legislative political actions of the Queen throughout her 70-year reign, I can do so, unless there was anything you would like to comment on at this point.
Yeah, the myth of neutrality in life. I think, I guess to a certain extent, the feminists in the 60s and 70s were correct in saying the personal is indeed political. Of course, they were doing it for evil reasons, but they weren't really incorrect because everything kind of is political, and the state and the liberal order that we live under its supposed dispensation, we're given to believe that the Constitution, whether unwritten or written, is sort of neutral. And it really isn't. It's not a question of how things are decided, it's who is deciding. And so that's sort of the myth we live under. And this is why we find ourselves sort of trapped or in cornered now, because these paper guarantees of civil liberties, Bill of Rights don't mean much if the culture has been so corrupted to the point where people can't tell what man, can't even admit that there is actually male, female. 2 plus 2 may not equal 5. How do you deal with people politically who actually may not believe it, but simply are willing to push that agenda? So that's essentially a correct analysis, but I'll let you continue.
Yes, and if I was in the room while someone made such an insane statement, as routinely happens now in the public square, I would have taken a political position. Even my silence on that, even the way that my body language reacts. Man is a social animal, and therefore he's a political animal.
It goes back to Thomas More's strategy in staying silent. Did it work? Did he keep his head?
right.
Not to disparage St. Thomas More, but I'm saying is after it turned out that England wasn't that different from Spain. If you're familiar with the classic 1966 movie, A Man for All Seasons, how that turns out. So, but I'll let you continue. I'm sorry.
Yes, although he did come to realize that, and then of course make his famous declaration of fidelity to the papacy.
He did, yes.
And to condemn the king's attempt to secure an illegal annulment of Catherine Aragon and so on, commit adultery.
At his trial, he spoke his mind. Yes.
Right, exactly. And sadly, that was a moment that the Queen never came to throughout her entire 70 years reign, despite many Catholics maintaining that she was some kind of Christian, model Christian ruler.
And Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn lived happily ever after, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, it was Jimmy Goldsmith who said that when a man marries his mistress, he creates a vacancy. And that was fulfilled later by Jane Seymour. Yes, with regard to this point about political neutrality is so important because it's a central conceit of liberalism, and it's a big lie. The classic and the most damaging example of all is religious neutrality. For example, the First Amendment of the United States, by declaring that there shall be no law made for the establishment of religion, what it's implying very strongly is that the truths of the faith are just not certain enough to be the basis of the ultimate basis of public policy and public law, which is a position with regard to the gospel, with regard to divine revelation, as taught by the one church that Christ founded. So it's a rejection of Christ's church. And indeed, the United States was the first European nation to explicitly make practical atheism in this way the cornerstone of its constitution. So that there is no such thing as neutrality, and the Queen has certainly not occupied a position of neutrality in her reign with regards to these discretionary statements. Now, we can get into the argument, the debate of does she have to follow the acts of her legislators and grant royal assent. But these are, I'm talking about comments in speeches, leaked remarks from from cocktail parties at Buckingham Palace and so on. She doesn't need to make those. right? That's that you know, constitutionally speaking, legally speaking, and yet she either was enthusiastic about doing so herself or succumbed to political pressure from her elected governments to do so.
This is the equivalent, it might be an invidious comparison, but like when the Pope comes out and starts to pontificate on matters that aren't strictly issues of faith and morals, on matters of politics, usually, or quite especially with this Pope, they creates a problem.
Well, exactly, right. And people, and you get these increasingly irritating so-called Pope-splainers who say, well, yes, he made a heretical statement, but it was just on an aeroplane, and that doesn't, you know, that's not the level of the extraordinary magisterium, so we don't need to worry about it. And while sort of strictly speaking, that might be true, that he, you know, obviously he can't change church teaching. Nevertheless, at the level of public perception, we think about this Marxist idea of praxis. If you ask the average person in the street, has the Pope of the Catholic Church approved gay marriage, most people would probably say, yeah, he seems to be okay with that, because he's created that perception through these discretionary public comments. So it's a way of kind of changing, so-called changing church teaching, but without changing it. It's very devious and it's very pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Similar with the interpretation of the Vatican II documents, where
there was
a method to the madness of the confusion of Vatican II, or how it was interpreted. And of course, people have done the work on Vatican II, about how it was infiltrated and hijacked in a way that was actually, you know, much more concrete and actually tangible if you look into it. It wasn't just a spirit. Actually agents involved with alphabet soup acronyms and all that involved in this. You know, so
yeah, which when you think about it logically, there would have to be proportional to explain the gravity of the collapse that happened after the council. That doesn't just happen as a result of a few ambiguities and things. There must be a deeper and stronger and more coordinated revolutionary element there.
Yeah, a coercive agent was introduced, because if you're thinking it was just sort of gradual decay, it would take a heck of a lot longer. Same with like the sexual revolution and the cultural, you know, upheavals that afflicted the West since 1945, meaning it isn't just stochastic events. Again, if you do the homework on it, their names, their addresses, you know, they have zip codes. You can call and talk to them if they're not dead yet. But yes, it's all there. So,
yes, I think this is where analysts like yourself and myself and other thinkers and commentators and researchers that we have dialogued with have perhaps almost benefited in a sense from some of the from postmodern thinking, in that we've turned it, we've adopted some of those sort of hermeneutics with regard to the dynamics of political events and cultural events and so on, and we've said, we've turned it on the revolutionaries, said, well, there is a political economy here to the discourses that they disseminate. And actually, it's not the case that, as they've told us for so long, that, you know, science is this neutral enlightenment space. No, there's a political economy there with regard to, you know, who funds who and who their interests are and what their family background is and you know, what their private lives are like and what kind of sins of the flesh are they involved in, and all of these human elements. And I think in that sense, postmodernism has been quite useful, actually.
These are what they call inducements to fraud.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And we can start to apply that lens and see that actually these proclamations of you know, grand universal principles and enlightenment and so on and political neutrality, they're actually just gambits for power. Standing behind that is the will to power. But in any case, to return to the Queen's political interventions, they increased, I think, towards the end of her reign, and they were increasingly bad. But she makes public address every Christmas, which is meant to be, you know, very much the address of the mother of the nation to her people, and to be an expression of goodwill, and also to express her position as governor of the Church of England. So as a spiritual figure, I mean, a heretical spiritual figure, of course, but that's at least the position that she claims to occupy, and that was a central part of her coronation. We are the last sacral monarchy in the world, other than the papacy, which is, you know, important. But she, in those addresses, has been increasingly explicit about her Christian faith, but also has touched on things like diversity and inclusion. Anyone can watch this this message. They can go to YouTube, type in 2004 Queen's Christmas Address, and she basically says diversity is our strength. She parrots the immigration and cultural policies of the then Blair government at that time, which was responsible for the most heinous and most vast destabilizing mass immigration that Britain's ever seen at that time. And in this address, it also cuts to a reception where she's meeting a number of public workers, and one of the women, and she says, "Oh, what do you do?" And one of the women says, "I'm a diversity and inclusion officer." And she said, "Oh, how good. How?" She says, "Oh, how important." So there's clear, you know, endorsement by the crown of this, great replacement level of immigration, a massive sort of constitutional change, a massive change to the complexion of the British nation. And then only last year, we had the purposefully leaked comment from another reception she was having via Zoom, where she said people who have never had a vaccine ought to think about other people rather than themselves. And this was amidst that very heavy pressure that we were all feeling at that time, where Italy had devolved into an apartheid state, and Austria was talking about mandatory injections, and Canada was banning truckers' bank accounts, and people were losing their jobs in the United States. And amidst that tyrannous environment, the Queen was lending her considerable influence to that campaign of fear and intimidation. So thank you very much for that. After that, she sent an address to the COP26 UN Climate Action Protocol meeting in Glasgow about anthropogenic climate change. And another leak accompanied that, where she was seen telling delegates, "I wish someone would stop talking about things and actually do something about this climate change." So again, that was an expression there of her sort of alignment with the most aggressive parts of the globalist agenda, right there with the anthropogenic climate change hoax. We've seen this time and again, this alignment, this re-expression of her government's policies at the time, and the policies, obviously, of the oligarchic powers that stand behind her government. Now, I'd like to go back to just considering first principles here with regard to monarchy, because this is something I'm afraid that Americans often get wrong. What is a monarch for? And I think it's perhaps best, first of all, to consider feudalism. Now, I've noticed that there's this description going around at the moment where the state of anti-Christendom, the New World Order, is being described as neo-feudalism.
Yes, yeah.
I don't like that.
It needs some clarification, yeah.
Well, I just don't think it's accurate. I think a much better description would be slavery.
Isn't that sort of the effect of Whig history, I guess?
Exactly. Yeah. Feudalism was a beautiful thing. Feudalism was a Catholic thing.
It's like the Dark Ages, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's we're not going back to the glorious light of the High Middle Ages. They want to take us back to the darkness and human sacrifice of pagan civilizations. Mm-hmm. That's what they want to take us.
They want the Aztec Empire.
Right. Exactly. So that's where people. Right wingers, unfortunately, have absorbed the commands of their oppressors by describing it as neo feudalism.
It's an inaccurate
definition, anyway, because here's the definition of feudalism, right?
Yeah, it's the spirit of 1776.
Feudalism is based on the feudal bond, right? That's the heart of feudalism, the feudal bond between vassal and liege. Mm-hmm. And the feudal bond is a fiduciary relationship, right? It's reciprocal, where fidelity is given in exchange for security. And a very good American expression of this that viewers might want to consider is the first scene in the first Godfather film, where the Undertaker goes to Don Corleone and he says, "I believe in America." And what he's saying there is the legal system, the social order has failed. You could say that's like the Roman Empire that was crumbling in the early Middle Ages. And so he's going to the local warlord, the local tough guy, and he's seeking redress for his grievance. He's seeking aid. He's seeking security, right, from Don Corleone, because the legal system has failed him. It's corrupt. These men have dishonored his daughter, and he wants justice. So he's gone to Don Corleone. And what does Don Corleone say? He says, "You know, I would have helped you if you'd called me Godfather, if you had the respect to call me Godfather." And then the Undertaker pays fealty to him, and he kneels before him and he kisses his ring. And then Don Corleone gives him. So you see there that exchange where the Undertaker gives his fidelity to Don Corleone and Don Corleone gives him security. And that's what happened in this period of the Dark Ages or the early Middle Ages throughout Europe. The newly liberated slaves peasants, the agricultural workers of the former Roman Empire, found themselves assailed by the breakdown of law and order, by the chaos of the barbarian invasions. And so they would congregate around the manors, previously of the latifundia, but the manorial system evolved at this point, of the often the local equites, the former noble class, or one part of the noble class of ancient Rome, and that warrior class, the bella torres, would provide protection. And when the Vikings came, for example, all the people would get behind the walls of the castle. And they wouldn't have to, you know, they would be safe there, and he would be the one spilling his blood. This is why the French nobility famously didn't pay tax, because they did pay a tax. It was called the impôt du sang, the tax of the blood. Only the nobility were required to render military service to the crown. So yes, their tenant farmers, their vassals, pay them taxation, which is an expression of that fidelity that's promised, but they have to give them security. So it's a reciprocal relationship. It's not just the case that these are just people that they dominate for their own private interests purely. That's slavery. So in other words, in feudalism, the lesser vassal gets something from the liege, right? And that's why I think this description of neo-feudalism is inaccurate, because the oligarchs, the Judeo-Masonic oligarchs who are building this new system, will not give you anything. They will not give you security. They will be the most rapacious slave masters that the world has ever seen. We can already see that now. So that's why this neo-feudalism.
They're offering us insecurity, actually. Fear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they are offering you chaos and disorder, and they will. You know, grind every last erg of labor out of you, use you as sex slaves. You know, the most heinous things. They'll deny you the possibility to even breed and have people have a family and live with people who you love. So yeah, they've really perfected that evil. Monarchy is just the supreme feudal relationship in the realm, where you have this fiduciary relationship, where someone is represented under an obligation to defend his interests. So the sovereign is the representative of the people before foreign powers, before any domestic power that sought to assert itself against the common interest, and in a certain sense before God, because the monarch was crowned by the church and thus received their sovereignty from God. So the king was bound to the people in this fiduciary relationship with three terms: the sovereign, the subject, and the law of the land. Thus, it is imperative the sovereign has an obligation to defend their subjects and an obligation to respect and protect the law of the land upon which their own claim to legitimacy is founded. Now, obviously, in history, those obligations have been violated. But what the problem we have today is that they are violated in a secret way, in a crypto manner. We have a crypto oligarchy operating here, a shadow government, a deep state. The elected legislators who profess to govern, we all know, actually do not work for their electors, do not represent their interests. Now, it's my contention here that Queen Elizabeth II did not fulfill her fiduciary responsibility during her reign in protecting her subjects against the machinations of the cabal. So I've mentioned some of those discretionary political actions and errors that she made. I think it's worth touching on the legislative side, because here, again, it's been a long, sad story. If you look at Great Britain in 1952 and look at it in 2022, it's very clear by any measure, be it political, cultural, economic, social, diplomatic, that the achievements and self-confidence of the United Kingdom have diminished dramatically in those years. And that we historians, once the emotions have cooled and they're able to dispassionately appraise Queen Elizabeth II's reign, the only characterization they'll be able to give it is one of really an unmitigated disaster. Now, all these woeful developments pale in comparison to their shared cause, which is the big story of Elizabeth's reign, namely the near total evaporation of the last vestiges of Christianity or Christian sensibility in the realm. Now, obviously, as you mentioned earlier, Tim, this process of apostasy from Christianity has been in course for many centuries. But in 1952, you could still say that most British people had enough residual Christian sense to recognize at least most of the natural law, the importance of marriage, for example, the fact that stealing is a sin, the fact that, you know, the social commandments, shall we say, had public support. And in 1955, Queen Elizabeth's younger sister, Princess Margaret, was pressured into declining marriage to a divorced man, Peter Townsend, being, quote, mindful of the church's teaching that Christian marriage is indissoluble, end quote. And that was under pressure from the church and the Queen, mindful of the public scandal would result. Now, at the nightfall of the Queen's reign, all those beliefs, customs, sensibilities, those attitudes, they've gone, they've evaporated. And I'm afraid that this Christian diminution has been accelerated by and affected by the culture of death that has steadily achieved statutory establishment, the legalization of abortion, homosexuality, no-fault divorce, pornography, mandatory sex education, so-called same-sex marriage, every other horror that's assailed the remains of Christian civilization, through the granting of royal assent, the final stage of the legislative process. Now, there's a debate here. it's not just the case that the Queen could necessarily just refuse assent to any legislation she doesn't like the look of. Britain has an unwritten constitution, but nevertheless, the conventions, the fundamental principle of that unwritten constitution and the conventions that surround it are that Parliament is sovereign, not the Crown. And we might not like this settlement, this revolutionary settlement, being as it is the settlement that was inaugurated with the inglorious revolution of 1688, when the money power, when the Protestants, backed by the money power, this Whig oligarchy, backed by various Dutch Jewish backers, usurped the throne from the last Christian, the last Catholic sovereign of the United Kingdom, or at that point of England and Scotland, James II. But St. Thomas Aquinas teaches us that the passage of time has the effect of bestowing legitimacy on a political settlement. And this is why the US Constitution, which I would say is an un-Christian, an anti-Christian political settlement, nevertheless, today is a political, is a legitimate political settlement, given its acceptance by the multitude over those centuries at this point. And so an attempt to disturb it through revolutionary means, as we've seen with the Black Lives Matter protests and so on, is obviously a sinful action. If there's anything you want to comment on there, Tim?
Well, one thing, sort of cultural, I guess, observations regarding Great Britain. Two movies from the 1960s, Dial M for Murder and Alfie with Michael Caine. I think Dial M for Murder is early 60s with Grace Kelly, Ray Milland, and it's an Alfred Hitchcock story taking place in Great Britain. There's a scene in it where there's evidence. It's a lady's purse. And the inspector there is there with a bobby, British police patrol officer. And he says, should I take this down to the station house? He goes, yes. And he walks out with the purse around his shoulder. He goes, dear God, man, if you walk outside like that, you'll get arrested. So there you go. And then there's a scene in Alfie. Of course, Alfie is a story of a ladies' man who's sort of living a desolate life. And he's enjoying, this lifestyle as a young man. And I think he impregnates a married woman, and this is 1966, I think, a year before abortion was legalized in Great Britain, and he seeks an illegal abortion. And the portrayal of this is interesting because the doctor is portrayed as being particularly seedy, not progressive, and Alfie, who partially witnesses the abortion, the act, is horrified by it. And this is how the movie's portraying it. And it just, so sensibilities were such that movies in the 60s would portray this sort of residual Christian morality or decency or public sensibility. And so that's just, I'm looking at those movies, watching it, thinking, wow, I'm watching it 30, 40 years later, and that's how things have changed. So that's an example. Of course, movies themselves were a revolutionary tool. I think Henry Ford called it a rehearsal for revolution, movies, a rehearsal for revolution. And of course, considering who dominates the movie industry, Hollywood entertainment, it is an avenue for cultural revolution and a very effective weapon for that objective. So just an observation, sorry.
No, thank you. I mean, if you're going to chain a population to the ground, then you need shadows to cast on the wall, mm-hmm. to beguile them. And that's interesting about those films. I wasn't familiar with either of them. But it is shocking that abortion, when it's legalized in the UK in 1967, makes the UK the second ever national government after the Soviet Union to legalize abortion. But as you point out, and as opinion polls showed at the time, most people were opposed to it. But they weren't opposed to it enough to raise a hue and cry and actually resist this tyrannical action of the legislature.
So the Queen could have said something and had the public behind her.
That would be my contention, yes. But the people didn't care. This is one thing that I try and emphasize in my discourse, which I think gets missed out, is that as much as we decry the awful effects of cultural debasement and currency debasement and degradation in our times, this decline that we're experiencing, people, God is allowing it because people have accepted it. The multitude have, by and large, accepted it. And we know that because it's happening. If people genuinely had enough faith and abhorrence towards the evil, then God would grant us the strength, the grace to reverse it. But there's a certain sense in which people are inviting it. It's a bit like when you look back at the Protestant Revolution in England, which was the great tragedy, the most severe national trauma this country's ever experienced, this great wrenching. And several scholarly works have shown how vibrant and pious and devoted the English church was in the years prior to Henry VIII, and how you know, this myth's gone around about the corruption. Obviously there were problems, but actually if you look at the popular devotions, the processions that took place, evidence from the Mary Rose, the kind of things that occurred in people's wills, all of the contemporary accounts and observations and so on, it all points to this very strong Christian faith in England, possibly you know, among the most fervent population in Europe. And yet the elite are able to impose the Protestant Revolution and steal church property, a third of the land which is owned by the church and exercised for the common good is taken away and absorbed in for private interests to turn over to sheep and accrue these massive fortunes. But why does God allow that? Well, it must have been in a certain sense that we deserved it, or that we weren't praying enough. You know, do you not think that God could reverse the course of the winds that blew the Spanish Armada away from the south coast when they were carrying the Duke of Parma's 30,000 troops? He could have changed the course of the wind and they could have landed in southern England, been received by the still largely Catholic population and changed the course of history, turned England back. But people must not have been praying enough for it. So that's a mystery. This is conjecture. But anyway, that's why I think that God allows things like this, the abortion horror in our age, that in a certain sense it's being that enough people are complacent and indifferent to allow it. Now, yes, the Queen, nevertheless, Queen, who always claimed to be a Christian, and the Church of England is still, although very, very vague and waffly about things, ostensibly against abortion, should have, at this point, denied royal assent to that piece of legislation. Now, there's one argument that to do so would cause a constitutional, would certainly cause a constitutional crisis and would also deny that principle of parliamentary sovereignty and thus would constitute sedition, because the Queen would be arrogating powers that do not belong to her under the Constitution by resisting parliamentary will and thus carrying out an immoral coup d'etat. There's another 1 Peter 5 article by my friend Jamie Bogle, which makes this argument, and thus the Queen had no option but to grant royal assent. But I make the argument in my article that actually, while it's true that is the teaching of the Church with regard to sedition, I think that the Queen to have denied royal assent would have constituted a just rebellion against a tyrannical government. And now this is something that American Catholics frequently invoke with regard to your own revolution against King George III. We won't get into that. But what Thomas Aquinas writes is that a tyrannical government is not just because it is directed not to the common good, but to the private good of the ruler, as the philosopher states. Consequently, there is no sedition in disturbing a government of this kind, unless indeed the tyrant's rule be disturbed so inordinately that his subjects suffer greater harm from the consequent disturbance than from the tyrant's government. Indeed, it is the tyrant rather that is guilty of sedition, since she encourages discord and sedition among his subjects, that he made lord over them securely. For this is tyranny, being conducive to the private good of the ruler and to the injury of the multitude. Now, is there a more perfect description of the political state of affairs that obtains in our day? We've got this shadow elite who are governing for their own private interests against the interests of the common good, the interests of the multitude. They're causing injury to the multitude. They are guilty of the sin of sedition, encouraging discord and sedition and so on, and frequently are breaking the law, just a matter of course, through their banking and through their intelligence activities, their black ops and so on. Now, surely the Queen knew all of this. Now, I don't know whether she had read the angelic doctor's teachings there, but nevertheless, her conscience, if she was truly a Christian, and we don't know, but her conscience should have been troubled by this culture of death that was getting statutory establishment. And I think this constitutes grounds for her to have denied royal assent. And I think, as you mentioned, the sensibilities, the conservative sensibilities of the British people at that time would have been behind her. And I think the oligarchs might have taken a hit. Things might have been delayed.
Yes. I mean, as the matriarch, if you will, of the realm, she had a responsibility. And I believe in her oath, she does swear an oath to God. And by that, you have to natural law. And so if laws are passed that violate the natural law, she's obligated to oppose it in any way she can. There's a standard of reasonableness in government. And when government becomes unreasonable, the legalistic, you know, formalities have to be thrown aside. And so although her role was largely ceremonial, you know, through tradition, 300, 400 years of political process in Great Britain, she did have technically she had the power not to give assent. Then she could have appealed to popular will in the 1960s and 70s, the 60s regarding sexual matters, and the 70s maybe regarding immigration. There were politicians like Enoch Powell willing to speak up, and the sort of the mass immigration that began in the 70s really kicked up in the 90s under Tony Blair and his minister of immigration, Barbara Roche, who happened to be Jewish, by the way. It wasn't a coincidence there, because she said her number one issue is fighting anti-Semitism. Well, that shouldn't be your number one issue if you're a British government official. It should be the defense and welfare of the realm, not the Jewish people. But that's a problem that's all around us today. But immigration was never popular. And neither was abortion or even some of the sexual things. Now, the thing is, those in a liberal society, those in charge of culture, meaning, you know, the private sector, they have an ability to propagandize and manipulate, corrupt the morals of the people because of concupiscence, right? There is a tendency to sin. And at some point, this is where not just an appeal to popular will, but appeal to authority. Maybe a parent will invoke his or her authority when chastising a child or directing a child about something, because children and young people are gullible. They don't have enough experience. They lack wisdom by nature of their age to make these decisions. They have to be guided the same way that we should have adults in the room in charge of our society. And a monarchy is well placed to do that if it sees its role properly and it's not corrupted. A monarchy, you know, has a sense of proprietary relationship to the government. You know, a king or queen isn't some, you know, ready politician who's exploited a corrupt political process and has been bribed and blackmailed and now is installed in power, which, as you allude to, represents most of our political class today. You know, enough of them are bribed or blackmailed that we do not have no longer have representation. Therefore, we don't have legitimacy. And therefore, someone has to step in and cut the Gordian knot, so to speak. And all these liberal vanities or lies about neutrality and constitution, rule of law, our democracy now. Our democracy is now abortion on demand, transgenderism, and whatever perversion that the regime wants to impose upon us. We're seeing that in America today with the abuse of the Justice Department, the FBI, and the Biden administration. Of course, his isn't the first. He's just he just happens to be the corpse filling filling the chair. He's not acting. He's being acted upon, and he has handlers the same way that the British established political establishment has their handlers. But if there's anything, a monarch, given his position, does have a position to step in, even if they're a figurehead, they can at some point step in and say no more. We're not going to do this, and they haven't done that. So again, an issue like abortion and also like immigration would have been a prime issue for the queen to step in and go, no, this is against the welfare and the well-being of the people, of the realm, and I'm not going to stand for it. At the very least, make a public statement again, not give her assent or make some statement in an interview that, her number one concern is climate change or something,
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Given that she's happy to make those discretionary statements in a revolutionary direction, how about making them in the direction of the oath before God that she's sworn is apparently so important? And what is a monarch for? It goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's to protect their subjects. And these evildoers, these wicked men, are removing a whole group of her unborn subjects from the category of personhood and allowing murder.
At the same time, they're flooding the country with foreigners.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as you would expect with someone in such a grave position of responsibility, that perhaps guilt over this terrible process started to affect the Queen more and more. And maybe that's why she started speaking up more and more about her faith towards the end. But sadly, hints and so on are not enough. You've got to be explicit. Interestingly, parenthetically, Peter Hitchens speculated that if you consider the anti-Christian revolution in total, the sequencing, it's quite surprising that the push for child sacrifice, for abortion, occurs relatively early in the process, considering the horror of what it entails. Why did they push for that so early? And only now are we getting, or recently have we had things like, so-called same-sex marriage and so on, which would, much less heinous in the sense of the destruction of innocent life. And he speculated that the revolution decided to expend significant political capital at that time, early in the revolution, to dip the hands of as many people as possible in blood so that they would become complicit in the revolution and accept its future actions and imperatives further down the line.
Yeah, there's two ways you can react to guilt. One is rationalize your guilt and become part of the howling, silly mob out there celebrating infanticide, or you can go to confession and seek absolution for your sins.
But the problem is this coincides with the time when the church, mm-hmm. the human element of the church, the leadership, was busy telling the world that there is no such thing as or stopped talking about sanctifying grace and had stopped talking about the need to confess and to be baptized to be saved.
Yeah, when a world is bathed in so much blood and awash in so much sin, perhaps a quickening process is necessary. This is perhaps God's will at play here. Divine providence, steps in and our enemies, they go too far and they expose themselves, which they've been doing this for, at least for the past couple of years, I think, where there's been sort of a reveal. I quipped, what if the apocalypse has already occurred and no one's noticed? Right, it's like it's not going to be a Hollywood apocalypse, with like a giant 100-foot demon strutting the land. No, it's occurring all around us. So there is an opportunity here for sort of an awakening, and an awakening will precede a conversion, a reconversion. that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are no natural solutions to a supernatural problem here.
No.
And that nothing will get better until the shepherds of Christ Church decide to stop denying him and turn back to Christ and start preaching the gospel to the world again. And I'm afraid I'm very pessimistic with regard to, you know, national conservatives or nationalist populist political figures. As a concept or a prospect in and of themselves, but even the realism of their achieving government, I think is highly, highly suspect. It's highly doubtful in any kind of short time frame, because of, to go back to this dipping of the hands of the population in the blood of the revolution. Let's take somewhere like Sweden, for example. Now, recently, a lot of right-wingers got very excited because the Swedish Democrats got the most number of votes, the plurality of votes in the Swedish election. Now, if you actually look into it, they got 22% of the vote, right? And they have a proportional system, so there are many parties. But in the last election, I think it was 2018, Swedish Democrats got something like 90% of the vote. So they basically had a 3% rise in the vote. But what they don't say is the Social Democrats, who have ruled sort of in perpetuity, their vote went up as well, I'd have to double check. Anyway, I think it moved by 3%. Let me check this because I want to get this right. 2022 Swedish election. Bear with me. Yeah. The Social Democrats won the most number of votes. They won 30% of the vote. Their vote went up by 2%. Swedish Democrats went up by 3%. So the Swedish Democrats basically picked up the votes from the collapse of the Christian Democrats and the kind of old center-right parties. Now, what that shows is that they are making very, very slow progress. And there's in all these countries, including, for example, Italy, you've got 30 to 50% of the population who are homosexual, single mothers, blue haired, you know, this kind of human, you know, I don't want to say refuse, but, you know, these deeply damaged people by the sexual revolution who will always vote left. Doesn't matter, you know, how catastrophic the situation is. They will vote for more mass immigration because they've got discordance and chaos in their souls. They need to replicate that chaos in the political order.
You can't have public order or political stability if people are unstable or chaotic in their personal lives.
Right, right. So this many years
have been dedicated to promoting disorder and chaos in personal lives in the name of freedom.
Yeah, I mean, what sort of society are you going to have when?
Then you get political authoritarianism as a reaction.
Yeah.
Even Aldous Huxley wrote about that. And he wasn't a good guy. He admitted it. He said, you know, sexual libertinism or liberty usually corresponds with political authoritarianism. And if you look at blacks in America, it's a great example. How free are you? Yeah, they're sexually free, but you can't walk down the street because of crime, you know. So.
Indeed. That's the case in all these countries now. And so I am, that's why I'm very skeptical, even of the prospect of these nationalist populist parties coming to power. The Fratelli d'Italia, Giorgio Meloni's party, still only got the most number of votes, but it still only got like 22% of the vote. There is still a huge block in all these countries that will always vote for more Mohammedan immigration, more sexual degeneracy, and so on. They've chosen to ruin their lives.
This was baked into the cake as soon as America occupied Italy in 1943 or 44.
Right.
What are you saying? Because, you know, everyone's saying George Meloni is a fascist, and, you know, because of these moderate social conservative views. And she gave a very good speech. And in that speech, she betrayed an understanding of what's the importance of family and religion. Well, this is a source of identity, and they hate identity. That was a spot-on speech. Now, to what extent that's going to transmuted or conveyed into policy, I don't know. Because the powers that be, again, these things aren't occurring in a vacuum. But remember, yes, she is a fascist in the sense that neurotic Jews define fascism. I mean, when you invoke family and community, according to Jewish neurosis, as written in the Authoritarian Personality, this is the seedbed of fascism. Because you respect hierarchy, you know, the respect for legitimate hierarchy and authority, these things. This is all, according to neurotic Jews, a source of fascism, authoritarianism, and community. And they disdain community because they do well in chaotic situations as a well-organized, you know, elite or, you know, minority. Again, this is a liberal, but problem is we're talking about the lies of liberalism. You know, how do you have a liberal order if certain groups don't play by liberal rules and they still invoke, you know, ethnocentrism and nepotism to inveigle themselves and take over a system? And this is a reality that we're dealing with now that we're told because of the past 70 or 80 year narrative we can't discuss because of Hitler. You know.
But the fact that, that kind of psychological conditioning operation and those aspersions have an operative effect on the minds of the ordained clergy, the men who are chosen according to the order of Melchizedek, handpicked by God to offer the voluntary sacrifice, and their priority in their mind is not offending those Judeo-Masonic sensibilities, that is, you know, is their kind of highest principles, rather than the undiluted purity of the gospel.
Well, no stereotype.
What the judge is always taught.
Their goal is dialogue. It's not conversion.
Right.
Well, if the objective of your dialogue is not conversion, then you should not have dialogue. Because it's going to work against you, and it has in the Catholic Church. You know, and that's what's happened, is the idea that you got to know you have an enemy. You can love them, but you can't deny that you have them. Even Christ said that, you know. You love your enemy, but you still acknowledge you have an enemy. Then you have to be clever about these things. You think strategically, you know. But the church, is, if anything, the past 67 years has not thought strategically in its dealings with the modern world. In fact, the whole Vatican II said we have nothing to fear from modern world. Well, that was ridiculous, you know. And again, Ottaviani, from what I understand, was originally maneuvering against both communism and capitalism, and that was with John Courtney Murray and everything. That was maneuvered away against that. And you know, there are all types of intermorifica with these warnings about media and these things. And they worried about what it was. Freudianism, what do you call it? His psychological method. That's a
film. Psychiatry.
Psychoanalysis.
Psychoanalysis, right.
Psychoanalysis in Hollywood were the two main worries that the church was talking about. Well, who controlled psychoanalysis in Hollywood? So we have to put these in ethnic terms because you have to identify the enemy. It's like you're fighting World War II and you're saying, don't talk about Germans. Well, from the standpoint of World War II, that conflict, you had to identify the Germans as a political collective, right? Regardless of the fact there were many, many, quote, good Germans. I'm not going to get into the, you know, World War II and revisionism, that's a time for another discussion. But I'm saying is, we have no problem saying the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor or the Germans invaded Poland. And you're not going to say, not every German invaded Poland. Well, no, but you know what we're talking about here. So let's talk like adults. But anything, the political rhetoric, and what you said, the conditioning has denied us the rhetoric and the knowledge we need to engage this battle effectively. That's why we've lost everything the past 60, 70 years.
I think it's one of the reasons, but fundamentally, I think it's the lack of faith.
Well, again, it goes back to, if your faith matters to you, then they have to be converted, acknowledging you know, the rejection of their faith makes them the enemy. And that's in the gospel. I mean, didn't St. Paul say they're the enemy of mankind? It was a funny.
Yes, and a reading of Acts shows that the persecution of the early church by the Sanhedrin.
Yes,
is not just an historical account, or as in a approximate historical account of the early church, but is also showing a pattern that's going to continue in history
and intensify.
And that's why it's mentioned in 2 Thessalonians. That's why you have Revelation 2:3 and Revelation 2:9 and 3:9, synagogue of Satan, mentioned. That's the reality. But at the moment, unfortunately, humanly speaking, we have a brainless church. We have a cowardly church. And they're not willing to forego, let's face it, the immense material comforts that this Marxist capitalist world is able to procure.
So then this speaks to the issue of, you know, they say the West or the United States, we have a less liberal, we don't have an established religion, but we do. It's called Mammon, right?
Right. Yes. Mammon. Exactly. Yeah. And we worship money, and that's why the money power has usurped sovereignty. Talking about sovereignty, you know, this is something you've talked very lucidly about on many occasions. But the creation of money, the creation of credit, is a sovereign power.
Mm-hmm.
That's a public privilege, and yet that has clearly been usurped by private interests.
And we're talking in a spiritual sense, like, you know, we all desire material comfort. I'm talking about in a practical, functional sense, where the central banks, and if you want, you know, you follow the work of Catherine Austin Fitz and the creation of these central banks, a Bank of International Settlements, these relationships between the banks and the fiduciary responsibilities that these banks have and corporations have, there literally is a physical structural existence which is the money power, which suborns and subordinates the authority and sovereignty of national government. It's called national debt.
Yep.
Sovereign debt. You know.
And scripture tells us that the debtor is under the power of the creditor. Banks create the money supply, and we're now reaching a sovereign debt crisis where countries are now almost unable to service the interest on their own debt.
We're coming off the end of a 500-year cycle, I think, which is why it's so hard for us to interpret. It's like, whoa. I mean, we've been in this system for five centuries, and it dates back, I guess, as far back as maybe the Bank of England. And this gets back to the Glorious Revolution, which the Bank of England was created 6 years later, right?
And exactly, yeah. And the money power, the City of London at that time, which orchestrated or was part of the network.
We're talking about the City of London. We're talking about like a two city block,
the square mile, yeah, which exists today and is not part of the United Kingdom. This is something people don't know, that the now the king has to ask permission to go there. he's not sovereign.
And same with the Bank of International Settlements, right?
He's not sovereign. Yeah, they have sovereign immunity. Mm. And the City of London has a representative in Parliament. It's called the Remembrancer, and which gives them, you know, access to, you know, discretion of financial scrutiny of financial legislation. The government of the City of London, the Lord Mayor, and the alderman, is chosen by a board of private banks. Of this territory, and that square mile has been the engine of international finance, you know, for over 300 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And if people understood that as Richard Werner put it, and he's, I would say, one of the most, I find one of the best thinkers, along with Catherine Austin Fitz, to understand this financial alchemy. But if people understood that for the oligarchs, the money creation is their greatest power, naturally speaking, I think supernaturally speaking, so we're talking about currency debasement, just as we talked about in one of our first interviews, currency debasement and cultural debasement, this dual scourge of sodomy and usury.
Yes. Yeah. And it creates coercion. There was a lot of people say, well, people can choose. But coercion can take many forms, and it may not be direct. And one good example would be like Weimar Germany, which is brought under, you know, debt, which is usury, and this crushes the German economy. This drives the great inflation. And you say, if you go into like Berlin, Weimar Germany, and you see boys and young girls prostitute themselves just to get money to eat, is that a voluntary transaction? When the material economic conditions were imposed upon Germany create desperation, which is then exploited. And that's what you get with debt bondage. It has the illusion of voluntary consent, like student debt, right? With colleges and student debt, where is it really voluntary to tell an 18-year-old to sign on to $250,000 of debt after he's been propagandized his entire life that he must go to college? Is that voluntary? Is that informed consent? And this speaks to, the, again, what's the morality behind this? We talk about, you know, the Glorious Revolution, and from what I understand, a driving force behind the Glorious Revolution in 1688, what you call the Inglorious Revolution, was the fear that the of a Catholic dynasty, because James II, I think, had, his wife had given birth to a son. But they were Catholic, although they had signed on to the, you know, the Protestant. The fear, again, the residual fear of Catholicism, Catholicism's historical opposition to usury, where usury set the stage for the British Empire being suborned by the money power, because you mentioned, you know, the third of the stealing of state of church property, rather, after Henry VIII broke from Rome, and this was the driving force behind it. That famous, the great quote by R.H. Taney, where as an upstart aristocracy had its fangs in the hide, and they weren't going to be whipped off with a sermon. You know, it was just a looting operation. But nevertheless, property didn't create money, and because of the greed of this new aristocracy, they wanted their houses, I guess, to match their greatness, right? Build these great manor homes, and they went into debt to the money power, which was the Rothschilds. And through the course of a generation or two, they became increasingly indebted to Jewish money power. And by the 19th century, the Bank of England was owned by effectively by Rothschild interests. And so the British Empire couldn't be separated from Jewish money power. And this is, and then you get the 20th century. Yeah. And to this day, it's very hard for people to understand what is the Illuminati? Who is Illuminati? Does it exist? What does that term mean? What's the money power? Well, it's been intertangled with this money power, which is characteristically Jewish and transnational and cosmopolitan. And we see those values expressed in things like corporate governance, dominance, people like BlackRock, you know, Larry Fink, and ESG, these things, this transhumanist, anti-human, you know, agenda being driven. And that's why it's so hard to identify. And of course, again, sort of the prohibition or against speaking again, identifying Jews as a problem, the Jewish question, prevents a clear analysis of this, of this problem, because, you know, again, if we can't identify the enemy, or at least an important faction of this power, how do you fight it? You know, because we're all worried about what someone might say about us, or we'll be canceled, or in some countries put into jail for talking about it. You know, so.
Yep. That was one way they did it. And another way was enclosing the commons.
Yes.
And basically, commodifying and privatizing public assets, breaking the feudal bond, these aristocrats, depriving the common folk of the pasture and cropland, the arable land of the commons, particularly the pasture land, so they could graze cattle and they could supplement their diet with protein sources, and instead choosing profit and enclosing it and then kicking the tenants off their farms, which would have once supported multiple families with arable land, and turning it over to pasture with just a single shepherd to care for vast flocks of sheep. The wool trade was very lucrative, and this created the capital to bankroll the investments in overseas markets and the domination of overseas markets through the British Navy and the creation of the British Empire, ultimately.
And of course, then the discovery of opium.
Right. And this process of enclosure, by the way, this is I think the main reason that the, or after the second main reason after religious reason, that the Whig oligarchy, the Puritan elite, overthrew Charles I and had him executed.
And didn't the enclosure movement create the paupery, the surplus labor that was then exploited by in the factories?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. The poor laws first come in under Elizabeth because of the dual effects of the deprivation of the social welfare system provided by the monasteries and the mass enclosure that goes on, that gathers apace at that time. And that's when you first start having the parish poor laws coming in.
Then you have transportation, right?
Yeah, that comes later.
More coercion.
and Charles I, tries to reverse some of these evil effects by fining lords who enclosed their lands. And he was prosecuting these lords in the court of the Star Chamber with his sort of high Anglican Archbishop, Archbishop Laud.
So you could say that Charles is was it Charles? I'm sorry, did you say?
Yeah, Charles the First.
Charles the First, because he loses his head over this. So you could say that Charles had sort of a make England Christian again.
Yeah, he was the commoner's king. He was the commoner's king. Yeah, he saw that the again, to go back to the St. Thomas Aquinas' teaching, you've got a part of society, part of the nobility, which are guilty of sedition, right? They are disturbing the common good through their own private interests. And he is trying to redress that. And that evil minority do not like people telling them what to do. And so they go to war against him and cut his head off.
Yeah, there's an interesting story. It's not a story. It's an understanding of the Irish potato famine. And this is the effect of usury. And E. Michael Jones writes about this in his book, Barren Metal, about the reason why Great Britain sent battalions to seize food from the Irish in the midst of a potato crop failure was to pay off the interest on the loans that they were carrying to build their manor homes. This is in the middle of the 19th century. And so you had to force exporting of food from Ireland during in the midst of this potato famine. Now, again, the Irish have been relegated to the potato because of British policy. It wasn't something that, Irish agriculture was as diverse as any. So it was a forced famine as any in world history. But this is so they could make their loan payments to the Jewish creditors. At the same time, while the British Navy couldn't provide relief for Ireland, it was bombing, the British Navy was bombing Greece to collect debt for for a Jewish creditor. You know, so there you go. So this is the effect of usury. And of course, the Irish potato famine creates this diaspora out of Ireland into the New World. And so the Irish come to America, and then there they are to either, fill the factories, cheap labor, or the Union Army during the American Civil War to crush the South. Again, this exploitation of cheap labor, because all this can be justified by Adam Smith, because it's all, supply demand. This is a universe created by the British cosmology, Sir Isaac Newton. This is gravity and inertia, supply, demand, love, strife. These things that E. Michael Jones writes about in his book Barren Metal. What's gone from this is a notion of morality or telos. There's a reason for this, or a divine providence for that. It's a very mechanistic universe. But they can be there to justify the expropriation and exploitation of these people, without them paying what remains of their Christian conscience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is your volume okay? Can you hear you?
Yes, no, it's fine. I wondered, if you had any further questions, any last questions?
No, I think we're coming up on an hour and a half. I think we kind of covered it. I think I wanted to cover Queen Elizabeth, the money power. I think we covered it. I said I'd have you for an hour and a half, and here we are. So I'm going to let you go. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Well, thank you, Tim. It's been a real pleasure, and I've got plenty more we can discuss another time, especially on this the machinations of the money power, because this is another article I'm working on, but trying to articulate why we're seeing this heightened aggression from the Judeo-Masonic elite towards the remains of Christian civilization at this current time. And it's my contention that they are following the sort of the imperatives of the inner logic of demographics and debt. And that they know that the bourgeois consumerist paradigm is over. And so that they feel that they need to carry out a controlled demolition of the current social order because it is untenable. And they need to establish a new social architecture with much more overt forms of political control.
Yeah, which is why people are finding increasingly impossible to buy a home, support a family, get married. Well, this is the money power being manipulated against that, creating the material, kind of creating the false scarcity. And this might get into why they're blowing up pipelines now. That's a whole nother topic, but it is related. So when do you expect this article to be finished?
I'm hoping in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
Before World War III kicks off. I mean, it'd be nice for it to come out and still be relevant. You know, still referring to something that they're planning rather than something that's happening right now.
I don't know. Yeah. They seem to be intent on just escalating. And again, it's for no good reason if you just look at the facts. I mean, obviously, there is an obvious provocation going on. You know, NATO has attacked NATO. Is there an article in NATO's doc charter for that?
Which article does that trigger?
What does that trigger? So, okay. So thanks, Peter. I'll let you go. Again, people follow your work best way.
Bondé Radio on both YouTube and Anchor FM.
Okay. I will provide those links. Yeah, well. So, when you finish that article, if I don't see it, send it to me, and that would be a topic we can go, you know, deal with that issue, directly next time.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
And thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the day.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Let it be, whisper words of wisdom, let it be. When all the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. There will be an answer, let it be. Yeah, let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. Words of wisdom, let it be.